You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for spending time with us this morning at the Brookings Institution. My name is Adi Tomer, and I'm a senior fellow in our Metropolitan Policy Program. I'm delighted to host this morning's program, Partnership for Sustainable Communities, Unfinished Business. If you love cities and small towns and rural areas, if you love the intricacies of how governments work together, I can promise you, you have come to the right place. I want to start, though, by taking us all back to January 2009, about 12 years ago. We'd just gotten through another hard-fought campaign season, a spirited competition that culminated in the first president in multiple generations who'd actively campaigned on infrastructure and built environment and local issues. Considering the president's rhetoric and the individuals selected to lead federal agencies, you could feel the priority that cities and towns would be for the incoming administration. And it was important they were, because the structural challenges facing American communities were immense. The financial crisis was still unfolding, piercing so many elements of society and our economy. The housing market was in a precarious state, with millions of families suddenly underwater on their mortgages, and many more losing their homes or their rental properties. Many of those same households saw one or more wage earners suddenly out of work as the economy shed jobs and economic output for months. All of this lost activity and financial insecurity punished local governments too, creating a kind of fiscal tsunami that would impact public budgets for years. And as if all that wasn't bad enough, the urgency of our global climate crisis became harder and harder to ignore. These were not the best of times. Solving those interwoven challenges wasn't going to be easy either. And the moment demanded more than new kinds of solutions. It demanded entirely new approaches. And that certainly applied to the federal government. A decades-long commitment to promoting single-family housing and highway expansions had become deeply rooted in our public policies, our governing culture, and certainly in how our communities function. Heat waves, rising pollution levels, unexpected floods and fires, they all demanded a more activist approach from federal environmental agencies to measure what matters, to rethink how agencies offer technical support, and to find new ways to tap the power of financial markets. And as more of our economic activity and households were concentrating in metropolitan areas, many small towns and rural communities were asking Washington for new ideas and more financial support. Into this void came the Partnership for Sustainable Communities. Devised by administration leaders and supported by congressional funding, the partnership sought to build communities that offered more affordable housing, transportation choices, and a more resilient built environment. The partnership was formally led by EPA, HUD, and USDOT, but we'll hear today about just how many other agencies took part in that process. This was a much bigger table than the public maybe knew. The partnership also invested real money, exceeding $4 billion through just 5 years, and encompassed a range of projects and programs. But the partnership was more than a set of capital grants and technical support to communities. The partnership was also a process change, a major experiment in how federal agencies and their staff could more formally collaborate to support their partners across the country. 12 years since that launch, history feels a bit like it's repeating itself. After a tough campaign season, where a new president made the built environment a focus on the campaign trail, the country once again has an administration poised to reinvest in communities of all sizes. We also face enormous structural challenges, including an intensifying climate crisis, a national awakening about racial and wealth inequality, and unmet demands for modernized infrastructure. American communities need a federal partner to help them achieve their grand ambitions, but no single agency can meet that moment. We're going to need to collaborate to prosper. Which brings me to the theme of today's session. How can we learn from the past to inform our collective future? In particular, are there specific lessons from the original Partnership for Sustainable Communities that could inform a similar idea here in 2021 and 2022? we've brought together some amazing people to help us answer those questions. In a few minutes, we'll bring three insiders from the original partnership, Doug O'Brien, Beth Osborne, and Maria Zimmerman, to discuss how today's agency leaders can learn from their experiences. But first, we're fortunate to have one of the figureheads of the entire effort with us. So I want to invite Ron Sims to the digital stage. Ron Sims is the former Deputy Secretary of the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. Ron served in the position for over 2 years, steering the department both through the early years of the Great Recession and through the launch of the partnership. As the King County, Washington executive for over a decade, though, Ron has been a longtime champion of what communities need, from big cities to small towns, and that advocacy was instrumental to getting the partnership off the ground. While Ron is now back in Greater Seattle, meaning he's up very early in the morning to be with us, he's still serving his community through board roles and was kind enough to join us this early. So Ron, the floor is yours.
It is an absolute honor to be able to participate in this wonderful work by Brookings Metro. We are the greatest country ever in the world, and we are challenged at times with things that seem insurmountable. We are going through an incredible period. This pandemic can define us or break us, or we can do what we've always done when faced with a challenge, which is to actually work together, get other people's ideas, integrate those ideas, and move forward with solutions. And that's why I'm glad that Brookings Metro is doing this work today, because it isn't going to be any single person, any single department, any single agency. It's not going to be just the federal government. It's not going to be just a city. It requires all of us. We have consistently gathered together and done extraordinary things. And we can do it again. Sustainable communities are the answer, in my opinion. When you look at the use of resources, when you look at the ability to gather people, when you look at the finality of the outputs, when you look at the culture surrounding sustainable communities and why it's important, it represents the best of who we are in this country and what we can do. There is nothing wrong with stealing an idea, nothing. Matter of fact, I used to say that the best ideas are always stolen. So I hope that all of you who are listening will find that one idea that becomes yours in your communities, within your working groups, within your agencies, where you can say, that's what we're going to do. This pandemic can define us for the next 20 years, or we can realize that it is a learning experience, that it tests our weaknesses, but makes us strong nonetheless. It allows us opportunities to correct and to achieve and to dream most of all. I have 5 grandkids, and I want my 5 grandkids one day to say, you know, there was a group of people who didn't give up, that there was a group of people who aspired, there was a group of people who achieved, who used their finance skills, their business skills, their planning skills, their hopes and dreams. And that was what the pandemic was the catalyst for. A new America, a great one, a reminder that it is an marathon, never a sprint. So all of you who are participating, I hope that you realize you're on a relay team. I used to climb mountains, and I remember that everybody counts on that rope team. Everybody counts. And I can remember one time wanting to cry as we got close to the summit of Mount Rainier. It was in such pain. There was a young lady behind me, and she said, Mr. Sims, if you cry, I'll cry. I said, why don't we both just hold our hands on this rope team, and we're going to ascend this mountain. The mountain is here. The mountain is here. And I want to thank Brookings Metro for reminding us that this is a mountain climb, but summits are achieved all the time. We just have to be collaborative. We have to work together. We have to achieve. That way I can keep my promise to my 5 grandchildren that their world will be much, much, much better than mine. That they will have seen a generation and generations achieve greatness when everybody else had folded their arms and said, woe me, there was a group that says, no, I am going to achieve. We are going to make a difference, and I'm going to be a part of that. So I want to thank everybody who's on the Brookings Metro team and everybody who's listening. Just want to remind you that things are not at the end. They're not at the beginning. The beginning's already started. The issue is, are you going to be the catalyst? Are you going to be the architect of change? Are you going to seize the moment? Thank you.
Thank you for those really inspiring words, Ron. We really appreciate it. And it's a great way to set the conversation today on what's possible here. So I want to thank you for your time this morning. And hope you can get some rest too. It's so early morning out west. So thanks again. And it's always great to see you. So I want to go ahead and invite the panelists up to the stage. We have got a great team here, as we talked about, who are at really the front lines of what was happening back in both 2009 and for years after it. So I'm going to go in alphabetical order to start it off. But fortunately here, this is a panel of all friends, and I've just got the front seat to get a chance to watch their conversation today. So Doug O'Brien is the president and CEO of the National Cooperative Business Association, CLUSA International. Before coming to NCBA, Doug led the work of the White House Rural Council and served in top positions at the U.S. Department of Agriculture focused on rural development. Having talked to Doug multiple times, but more importantly, hearing from his colleagues, I can promise you Doug is one of the more thoughtful and inquisitive and kind folks you're gonna meet working on these issues. Beth Osborne is the director of Transportation for America and also the reigning champion of all transportation panel events. Beth was formerly the acting assistant secretary for transportation policy and the deputy assistant secretary for transportation policy at USDOT. That's also the winner for Mouthful. And before that, worked for years on the Hill. Beth knows her stuff, but as you all will find later, she's going to be fairly short on opinions. And then Maria Zimmerman is simply one of Washington's favorite people, as voted on by everyone who's ever met Maria. Her work has covered a range of housing, transportation, economic development, and environmental issues. She's worked on Capitol Hill, helped run nonprofits, currently leads her own consultancy, which is where you tend to see her on the road, probably many people are watching today. And for today's conversation, Maria was the deputy director of the Office of Sustainable Housing and Communities. Hopefully those introductions already keep it light and make everyone who's watching today know that the four of us know one another. We are excited to talk about this. This is a casual but important conversation for what's happening in the country. And look, a lot of you chiming in today, I know the four of us, we've got to watch these federal infrastructure talks. They're exhausting. We're not going to talk about that today. This is something different that's going to happen around the bend, hopefully soon enough. So here's where I want to start us off. And we're going to go in reverse alphabetical order, which they know, but I want the viewership to know. It's already been about a decade since the partnership launched, and all three of you were part of that initial wave. I think it's worth starting folks off with some of those early memories from the inside about how staff were feeling about the push to collaborate across agencies and what the promise was around the corner. So Maria, let's start with you. How was HUD approaching the partnership and all that swirling activity around the I want to say stimulus, but for those of us who are old enough, that was what the stimulus was. Now it's a new stimulus, but aura and the stimulus at the time. How was all that swirling at the moment when you all got into your new offices?
Yeah, thank you, Adi. And I would say, first off, I'm excited that you're going reverse alphabetical because that never happens to me. So already this is my favorite panel of the pandemic. But also, we all just heard Ron Sims, and I had the incredible privilege of working for Ron. He was really the leader at HUD when the partnership was starting and for most of my time at HUD. And what you heard was literally like every meeting going in to meet with Ron was like, how are you going to climb that summit? Here's the aspiration. You can change the world. And then, so what have you done on that? What have you done to actually deliver on this ginormous promise and inspiration?
And inspiration and huge pressure.
Yes,
like, both. No pressure at all. Go change the world real quick.
Both. But it was great. And he brought that same intensity around issues of racial equity as well, both how we were staffing our new office. I will say, so HUD brought the money to the partnership. DOT also brought some money. But we had two new programs, $250 million that Senators Dodd and Congressman Olver were really the champions in Congress to create these new funding programs. At HUD, most programs have been around since the 60s, 70s. So this was a new deal, and they created a new office, which, so I was brought in, Shelley Paticcio as the director, and Shelley and I had worked together for years. I came in to work with Shelley. There were already amazing folks like Dwayne Marsh and Solon Gebergaz and other folks who'd been brought in. Philanthropy was kind of helping us staff up. I always say it was like a MacGyver office. Like, we never had the staffing or the resources to do what we were supposed to do. The rest of HUD, either through the bureaucracy that is HUD or because, hello, 2008 was a huge housing crisis. And so most of the agency was dealing with housing crisis. So here we're a brand new office, which HUD didn't really know what to do with. We had to figure things out on our own, every piece of it. And so part of our MacGyvering was, hey, can we get agency staff from other parts of government to come and do details in our office? Can we create a process that's inclusive, not only because that's what we're trying to test, but out of necessity for that? And I think we really, through having these two new grant programs, the Regional Sustainable Communities Grants and the Challenge Grants, as Beth and I will talk about, the aptly named Challenge Grants, you know, we were able to put resources into testing new concepts, cross-sector collaboration, interagency work, really seeing the federal government as being there to serve communities, not to dictate to communities. Yes, we did do some dictating in how we set up the program. We said everybody has to be at the table, so you can't just have one slice of your metro. Everyone needs to be there. We required 10% of the grant funding to be specifically identified to support community-based organizations to be part of the planning process. We allocated a portion of the funds for small and rural communities to make sure that they had a seat at the grant funding table. We also allocated a portion of our total funds to support capacity building. So we were doing a lot of new different things with it, but really we were trying to plant a lot of seeds with the thought of the partnership and our grants were really to try to stave off the next foreclosure crisis. Like, we were in this moment of crisis because no planning or poor planning had happened. In the 1980s, Congress got rid of the required coordination between between housing and transportation plans that localities were developing. And so this was like the first time in 20 years of like, oh, hey, maybe we should be talking to each other. And USDA had gotten rid of its planning program. So, I will say it was the hardest job I ever had in my career, but it's the job I'm the most proud of. So maybe we'll dig into both the positives and the negatives around that. But just an incredible group of people I got to work with within HUD. Such an honor, such a delight to work with them and across the federal agencies. Really, any conversation we'd have where people were like, oh, now I know somebody to talk to in X, Y, and Z. So I'll stop there. But it is, as you can tell, it was fast. It was furious. It was like a lot going on.
Yeah, it sounds like the cliche, a lot of challenges, a lot of opportunities. Beth, let's throw it over to you. I mean, you had a monster new competitive grant program that hit, to say nothing of everything else that Maria and Ron set the table for too. So what was the mood over there and what were the approaches that you all were starting to debate internally?
Yeah, you know, I remember my first day in the office and I met my career counterpart, Joel Zabot, and he said, oh, I hear you're going to be doing the livability stuff. And I didn't know that. And I was, oh, I am? And I was so excited about it, the notion that we were going to try to create something new and have these agencies work together. And you know, the real magic of it was, Secretaries Donovan and LaHood wanted to work together. They were seeking an excuse to do so. And what also worked really well together was the folks over at HUD and EPA and DOD, we all had known each other for a decade or more. I remember hearing a story about two agencies in Great Britain that formed a huge partnership, and someone asked the two heads what the magic was, and they said, well, we're married to each other. Yeah, you know, so it was kind of the same thing. It was just this group of people who had loved hanging out, now had a great excuse to collaborate together in our kind of mission-based personalities. And then along the way, we got to find people who we should have known for decades before, like Doug, who just fit right in. And we knew as soon as we met him, we needed him to be part of this. We had some great opportunities because starting on projects is a great place to start. And these new competitive grant programs were a useful way to orient ourselves. And I will say that this conversation today is extremely well-timed and useful because we do need to revisit what worked and what didn't work. If we do nothing but copy an idea and effort of 12 years ago without any change or improvement, we will be doing something as tired and boring and fruitless as that sentence sounds. You don't innovate, which is the goal of this sort of collaboration, by doing exactly the same thing over and over. So it's time to figure out what we did well and should be repeated and what we blew, because we did blow it on some things, so that the next group can do it better.
Yeah. Yeah. If anyone thought that because the positive tone, especially with Ron, was like, that's just like the honey to like come in here to actually talk about the critique, right? So thank you for previewing what's about to come. So Doug, let's throw it to you, because you've actually got a really important role here in the intro besides introducing yourself to everyone, even though the three of us know you. Is that, as I kind of mentioned in the intro, the table was bigger than what many folks saw from the outside. So talk a lot about, if you can, of not just USDA's role, but other agencies, as well as in particular, this smaller community and rural focus, which was always there in the wording. But right, we know this. I mean, there's many more people live in metro areas than rural areas, but they're all equally important. And there's a lot of really amazing sustainable community planning that can go on in those smaller areas. What was the attitude inside the White House, inside eventually USDA, and how did this all kind of start in those kind of corners of the federal apparatus?
Yeah, well, thanks, Eddie, and it is so good to be part of this conversation, to see the colleagues and great friends made. So yeah, I'll just let me answer your question. I'll put it in three buckets really quickly: people, policy, and politics, and the people. It was a very interesting dynamic from USDA and from some of the rural stakeholders. So, I mean, just to put it out there right off the bat, some of the framing and some of the, some of the messaging, even some of the priorities of the partnership in a lot of rural places, it didn't immediately resonate. You know, so there was for those agencies like USDA, EDA, which has a huge, you know, rural footprint, the regional commissions, particularly the Appalachian Regional Commission, you know, we approach this very excited. And of course, when you come in a new administration, you really have that oomph to work together and to work towards the administration's priorities. So we were looking for ways to be part of it and to be, to contribute. But at the same time, we had some sensitivities, you know, and in the way that kind of played out for USDA, we ended up creating a work group, a rural work group that we were a formal partner of, but we didn't sign on the dotted line. You know, the secretary didn't sign on the dotted line in terms of the big three sort of, but we did a lot of work. And I think, and I have to call out EPA just did a fantastic job of continuing to work in rural places and really pulling USDA in, along with HUD and Department of Transportation. And then ARC, I mentioned them before, but the Appalachian Regional Commission, they have some flexible resources, and they really, they were looking, and they're always looking for ways to be part of a larger effort. So they there's some great examples that we could mention that were in their footprint. So the people piece, and then I'll try and go really fast. Just, I know there's a lot of the federal family that's you know, with us today. And I got to say, one of the great advantages on a personal level is that, you know, engaging in this type of cross-agency work, it gets you out of that silo that you're forced to, you know, you're working towards your strategic plan within your agency. And then you get to go to some of these meetings and you have conversations and you really do open your eyes. And they're different people, different perspectives. And it's just, it's a great, actually, professional development opportunity, which I had no idea that that's what it was when I was in the middle of it. But it was like, oh, man, I just really expanded my horizons. You know, that's a personal thing. That on policy, I'll just mention real quick is that, and maybe we'll get to it, but kind of on the shadier side of all this, trying to put together federal resources and on one project can be enormously difficult. It's just, that's not the way that the law was originally written with the politics and policy priorities of a particular, you know, committee on the Hill. And then, you know, general counsel and policy people, they created these regulations 12 years ago. They did not have any vision of doing anything like this. And so just trying to put these things together was really tricky. And sometimes we probably over, to Beth's point, sometimes we overreached actually, and we thought we could do something and it just couldn't get done. You know, so that like one point on that is, and we did it fairly early, but not early enough, getting the general counsel and like the political, either the general counsel or the deputy involved in cross-agency work super early is really important, I think. And then I'll talk about politics just for a second. And I referred to a little bit is that at the end of the day, to really make this thing go to scale and sustain, the committees, both the authorizing and the appropriators on the Hill need to get invested in it. And that wasn't consistent for this effort, I think. I think there was, on some of the committees that were involved, there was good support for it. I mean, it came from it, you know, Maria mentioned that. But then there were some committees, they just like, it wasn't in their priorities. And so it was really hard to get them to, you know, to come along and kind of build that policy ecosystem. But anyway, that's my first comments.
No, that's fantastic, Doug. And that's actually where I want to go next, as I alluded to too, is, and I'm glad you and Beth both did that, is kind of look like it's really easy to have, to speak positively about this program, certainly because of the results on the ground, which we'll get to success maybe in a second, but I want to stay on this challenges bit, that it's really important, especially we know there's a lot of folks who are working inside these agencies who are with us today. And they have such a great chance to hear from all three of you together at once, right? It's almost like a private workshop setting, right? So, except you all are on the record here publicly. So, but don't worry about it. The point is, let's get those challenges out. What was hard? Like what, there's a term that was floating around Brookings Veteran at the time, because we collaborate with a lot of you all, again, just purely external, but it was unnatural act, right? Like this is an unnatural act. So what was actually unnatural about it versus the right? I'm sure the relationship building that comes naturally when great people come together, forming friendships, but what didn't work well? What was hard? What was annoying? You know, you brought up Doug, some of the legal side, like more of those bits. And I want to open to the floor because you all know each other and I'm here to stay out of the way. So let's get these out there so folks know.
Yeah, I would say it's a long list, but a few things that come to mind, and Doug, you mentioned a couple of these. I learned early on, but I wish I'd even learned it earlier. So this would be my nugget. Never ask general counsel, like, can we do this? Ask them, is there a reason we cannot do this? Because they'll never say yes to something new. Sorry to the general counsel folks who may be with us. But
you might even have to go further and say, who's going to sue us if we do it?
Yeah, and I'd be like, Beth, you know this. I'd be like, show me in the law where it says we can't do this. Now, unfortunately, in the law, there is a lot of things that make it incredibly hard to cross money between federal agencies. And, you know, we were required by Congress to produce a report to them for DOT and HUD, since we had the same appropriators, on barriers to collaboration. And I think half that report, Beth, was like, the rules you have created make it very hard for us to collaborate, like procurement, joint grants, reporting requirements, you know, the poor grantees who did get a combo DOT HUD grant, like we kept thinking, is there a way they could do one simplified reporting form? No. You know, we tried to do sustainability status at HUD, which was to recognize like, okay, these are just plans, but we have all these other implementation funds, not only in HUD, but in other agencies. So is there some way we could get preferred points that other agencies could use in their competitive grant programs? If you guys remember, the traumas around that. Mixed success, limited success, not really success in some places, but a lot of work and effort, even within HUD, trying to say like, okay, can we get other CDBG and others to think about this? And even trying to pilot some of the new approaches to fair housing, you know, within the building, there was such a history of kind of a litigious approach to fair housing. And we were like, we want to get ahead of that and be proactive. And so figuring out partnerships within the building to be able to do that took some time. And thankfully, we did have some good partners, but it was really hard. So those are some of the few that jumped to my mind. I'm sure you guys have others.
Yeah, you know, and I can get into some details, but I think it's just generally reviewing some of the positives and negatives of the experience. I will say I really struggle to call any of the experience negative, but looking back on what missed opportunities there were, does bother me now. And I don't think I recognized it in the maelstrom of the day. The good is we did allocate money to really important projects and planning efforts across the country that continue to bear fruit today. So that, like, right off the bat, we did a good job when we had money that we had discretion over in directing it. At DOT, while everyone got super excited about the Tiger program, now called the RAISE program, it was a itty bitty piece of our spending. So you'll have to forgive me in my lack of enthusiasm on directing most of $500 million well when we were directing $40 billion poorly. I have a big issue with that. And so I think the over-focus on those discretionary grants and what a great job we did with our piddly little pot of money is misdirected and something I think Democratic administrations fall into. So this is the missed opportunity side. Democrats in particular are so confident in their ability to manage a bad program well, they don't spend time institutionalizing change. And I remember this back when I first started on Capitol Hill in the late 90s. For those of you that were around then, James Lee Witt was you know, paraded across the country as an example of someone who reformed an agency and did beautiful work at FEMA. The day he left, all of his work fell apart because they institutionalized none of it. And I think we fell into that. We did great things while we were there. We formed new relationships that among career staff that's ongoing today. We encouraged people to think differently about things and gave them permission to take a different approach, which people continue to take advantage of today. And there are certain, you know, documents and guidance documents that are out there as an example of it. But we didn't, there are so many rules and regs and like at DOT, there's a guidance on how you value time savings in transportation projects. That thing should be taken down, burnt, and danced around. It's so terrible. We didn't touch things like that. There's so many things that the agencies have discretion over that we didn't make an impact on. And I think going forward, there needs to be a huge focus on those sorts of things. And the other thing is we didn't pull the new leaders in as well as we could have. So as, you know, people like Deputy Secretary Sims left and moved on, or a Deputy Secretary Percari at USDOT moved on, we didn't do a good enough job of engaging and bringing that new political leadership in. And as a result, I think our effort ran out of a lot of energy for lack of buy-in and direction. So the biggest thing I would like to see going forward is a yearly revisiting of the purpose, where the political leaders of the agencies give any interagency group a task with deliverables that they owe by the end of the year, with a commitment to collaborate on them, and then redo that with the new leaders every single year for direction and buy-in.
Well, I think those are great comments. I think Beth makes a fantastic comment that the work, as Maria kind of laid out, you know, there was so much to do to try to make anything, you know, work together, all of it, the relationship building, the policy stuff, trying to tweak that, you know, endless meetings. And there is a tension, I think, that Beth introduced of like, to even get the small amount of discretionary, relatively small amount of discretionary dollars to sort of work together. There was, you know, a bunch of people, lots and lots of staff hours, both in political and in the career civil servants, SES, you know, 15s, lots of people spending lots of time on this. Meanwhile, the 90% or really probably 97% of our budgets, we weren't going there. You know, we weren't paying attention to that. And you know, every administration, every time is different. It might be different now. I think it is different. You know, I think there was more caution 12 years ago. I'll just be really candid because I know we're completely off the record here, and not to be political at all, but I have to say that the administration, you know, between Obama and Biden, there were some things that they did that I looked at. I was like, man, I wish we would have done some stuff like that, or at least approached it in a way like that. It's like, oh, yeah, it's got to be legal, obviously. That's, you know, that's foundational, but you can do, you know, really big things. And sometimes the stakeholders you need to lead, you know, as opposed to just wait to follow. So so I agree with Beth on that completely. But you know, the fundamental, and this is something we certainly didn't solve, and I don't know exactly how it could be solved, but each of the departments has a culture, you know, right. It's built on, you know, policy and politics, and trying to get beyond that culture, you know, beyond just the margins, it's a huge task. I mean, those trails are very well trod, you know, from the Hill into the agencies, et cetera. So I don't want to, you know, downplay that. Then last thing I'll just mention real quickly is that I do think we talked about engaging private sector, and we did to some degree. But that would be something that I'd think about again, but honestly, from my point of view, the main private sector engagement with philanthropy, which was great. But in terms of those, you know, the private sector, you know, for profit and then really focusing on firms that are owned, controlled, and benefit the people who live in those places. I think that's one thing. And I happen to work at the National Cooperative Business Association. So that's a little self-serving, but I really do think that focusing on community owned, community benefit, private sector is a big piece of this.
No, I actually think it's a great point, Doug. And it's going to be a big part, if nothing else, of our broadband conversation right now. I'm saying that's happening in Washington is, you know, some of my colleagues have put a plug for them, just put in a co-op driven kind of real estate ownership model, you know, geared more towards moderate and even lower income households and neighborhoods kind of characterized, you know, by larger shares of them. There's a lot to like in there. And that's about building out stronger communities, more sustainable communities. And that kind of leads me into what I wanted to kind of prompt you all with next is, you know, taking away, and I'm prompting you to do that, so it's not a critique. It's like, okay, let's get out of like federal navel gazing. What was happening across the country? You know, because that's what's interesting is when you talk to federal folks, they'll talk a lot about love making the friendships. There was an incredible amount of idea sharing. Some of this work was really hard. Then you talk to local actors and they'll be like, I love that planning grant. Like that really changed conversations in our community. So to kind of, you know, we're obviously like whipping around here a little bit, but I want to go back to that kind of positive tone that, again, Ron kind of left us with, which is, you know, how did we change communities here? Because y'all did some amazing work. What were some of your favorite projects and what worked in terms of that collaboration, what you learned as a federal practitioner, at least at the time, of what communities needed from their federal partners? And again, throwing that out to the floor, anyone should feel free to jump in here.
Yeah, well, I'll maybe start again. I promise I won't start again the next time. But I absolutely, I feel like in some ways our grants were my additional children because I do a work in a lot of parts of the country and I'll hear from MPOs or localities or whoever of like getting that funding enabled us to start conversations that we hadn't had. The data that was provided around doing the regional fair housing equity analysis was the first time that we had really disaggregated to look at racial equity issues and disparities. So I think it really did change kind of the field of planning in some ways. I mean, really, like, I remember being kind of gobsmacked at the beginning of the program, particularly with MPOs. Like, MPOs, still a lot of them will be like, oh, we can't talk about housing because we don't do housing, we do transportation. And I'm always like, have you looked at the federal planning factors? No, housing is not specifically mentioned in those factors, but it talks about quality. It talks about all these other things, which is really about housing. Same thing with jobs. You know, MPOs, most of them didn't really think about economic development. So we did have, with EDA, thankfully, and NATO and other partners, you know, we were able to kind of seed through our requiring that they actually talk and investigate the data to look at things like racial equity, look at job issues, look at housing issues. And I know with our grants, they're in different parts of the country, there were private sector partners who were part of the conversation and the work, and were also leveraging additional resources. So we did have, and you know, we talked to Congress about this federal investment is leveraging 4 times to 6 times non-federal investment. And you know, we had chambers of commerce and others who would come up and talk on the Hill. But I think, you know, I think about places like the Chicago Metropolitan Area Planning Association that used our grants to provide local grants to communities to do update land use and transportation plans and do housing plans. They were, a lot of our grantees did that kind of sub-allocation local planning. Many of them figured out ways to use the Unified Planning Work Program to continue that funding, but a lot of them didn't. And so those activities ended. I do think, you know, I've looked back, like, I'm happy that FTA has had the TOD pilot planning grants. I think that's like carried on the legacy a bit, but I'm like, man, why didn't you do that in a coordinated fashion with HUD? Because really, these are the same thing, and bring in EDA and other partners so you're not just taking a transportation focus on TOD, you're actually taking a community focus. So I think, you know, I also think about some of the grants that were made to tribal communities and the work that enabled them to work across tribes and between tribes and local governments. And, you know, the grants that we made in South Dakota and Arizona and New Mexico, a lot of things where that grant helped to seed work that those communities, you know, continued and even provided much needed capacity support for them to engage in issues like, you know, opposing the pipeline and other things that have since moved forward. So, you know, and then just very specific projects. Some of the grants that we made, a grant, Dee and I just heard somebody locally who's probably on the call today was like, we did this project in Austin, Texas, and it required EPA funds and DOT funds and HUD funds. And because of the partnership, our regional administrator helped us do this to make this project happen that today is providing much needed affordable housing in Austin near transit. So there's lots of those that come to mind and I think have continued to evolve since the federal partnership ended. Like, people figured out ways to keep the work going, even if it looks differently than we envisioned. You know, a lot of that work happening in the vacuum of any federal leadership to do this stuff and even wins against it. You know, folks still trying to figure out ways to talk about equity, even when the last administration was like, do not talk about equity. So, yeah.
Doug, Beth, what were some of your favorite things that you saw across the country?
So if I was going to pick out particular projects, you know, through the Tiger Grant program, we did some projects that were really different from typical transportation projects, like filling in below grade highways in, you know, New Haven and Hartford, and particularly Rochester is a project I'm very proud of. We were talking about reconnecting neighborhoods before there were proposals about reconnecting neighborhoods. We also did some planning grants on taking down other highways, like the Claiborne Expressway, known as the Monster, that goes through Treme in my hometown of New Orleans, and the Sheridan Expressway. It was from that experience that years later, I sat down with you know, the person who is now in Senator Carper's office, and we came up with the idea of a reconnecting communities program is through those projects and what we learned. And, you know, a lot of what we learned with the New Orleans and the New York studies was it's not enough to give people planning grants or even money, that there are huge barriers. So one of the greatest things that these efforts taught me is we gave people the chance to plan. And through their planning, they found out where the feds stand in the way of them implementing these great plans. And on the takedowns, it is in tragically bad modeling, embarrassingly bad transportation modeling that is the justification for spending hundreds of billions of dollars. And unfortunately, policymakers are so ignorant to how bad they are. They don't know how embarrassed they should be by it. And we really need to update that because it stands in the way of people doing what they need to do and creating an economically powerful and resilient community for the people who live there. And then also, it's about considering that when you make an improvement to an area, you raise property values. Those things cannot be divided from each other. If you make an improvement and it didn't raise property values, it wasn't an improvement. That was a waste of money. So we have to build into these processes anti-displacement efforts that are very strong and powerful so that it doesn't become an excuse to not make the improvement. But, you know, just looking at some of the kind of detailed examples, you know, when Well, first, I'll just say how much fun it was to do these reviews with USDA, EPA, and HUD. When we sat down and reviewed all of the grants applications that came in, making livability claims, and we had, you know, EPA being able to tell us about efforts on stormwater in that area that they didn't even know to brag about in their application. And HUD could tell us about other things they were doing that maybe they didn't know to include, or sometimes we'd find out that someone was bragging about something that they hadn't quite done as well as they claimed. And, you know, Doug would be able, Doug in these meetings was one of the more entertaining parts because he is from every place in America. And every time a grant application came up, he had been there, lived there, worked there, something. It was crazy. And so he could tell us something very specific about it, but also reminding us to not apply urban or suburban standards to a rural area and to really think about the capacity of the community, because rural actually means a ton. And the last thing I will mention is we had a barrier when HUD and DOT tried to create a joint grant agreement with someone we sent money together to. And there are legal barriers to that that we never convinced Congress to get rid of. But beyond that, I don't think that our council really tried. I think they looked for every possible excuse to get out of being creative. And I think leadership from above needs to push them much harder to do better. Because the fact that giving $100,000 to a community meant they had to go through two totally separate grant agreement processes with two agencies is exactly why people hate government. And we need to do better than that.
That's right. That's right. That's where inefficiency commentary comes from. It's more there than the alternative. But Doug, I think the table got set for you perfectly. Yeah. What were some of your favorite things you saw across the country?
It's from everywhere.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I remember some of those. Those were fantastic meetings. And I could bring some very specific things, although usually not very useful, but they were very specific. I'll just mention two projects that come to mind, and they're a lot different, but they have some of the same positive long-term outcomes. One is my home state of Iowa, Waverly, Iowa, floods of 2008. So right before the administration came in, and it really jolted that community into looking at their plan. You know, with relatively small EPA resources to get the ball rolling. But in that case, you had a USDA state director. So just folks probably know this, but USDA has its unique organizational structure. And every state has a political appointee who is a state director who has a lot of say, or at least a lot of knowledge about the plethora of USDA rural development grants. You get that person at the table, and then suddenly USDA is a real partner. And that was like the EPA grant got got the partners to the table to look at their plan post flood. And it really changed this town of 8,000 people or so. And then you had USDA there who actually invested a lot of those dollars, along with eventually, you know, HUD and DOT were there too. And that's a place with relatively, there were partners. I mean, for a rural place, it was a place that had capacity actually. And it was about bringing those people together. Another example, Maria already alluded to it, was in Pine Ridge, the Thunder Valley. That was a place with fantastic leadership, with huge cultural assets. But in terms of the way that, you know, that agencies like ours, community economic development agencies, think about capacity, they didn't have a lot about that kind of capacity that we think about. I think the partnership and some of those early grants, it really did provide a platform that I saw, I was in for all 8 years, that I saw continued to grow in different ways. And of course, I mean, we haven't actually said this, so I'll mention it now, is that, you know, this, the dynamic or the tension of, you know, focusing resources and agency time into regional plans, and how you do it in places that lack resources and have been disinvested, discriminated against. It's, you know, that decision of where do we put the dollars in terms of where it can make a difference. Of course, the question there is, what does difference mean? You know, if your outcomes are, you know, jobs and near-term environmental outcomes with, you know, da-da-da-da-da, that's one thing. If it's about, you know, maintaining some type of economic base and increasing, you know, equity, racial equity, other types of equity, that's a different thing. So,
you know. And I just have to play Doug for a minute. Doug, since we've last seen each other, my sister has moved to and from Cedar Falls, which I believe is about 20 miles from Waverly. There you go.
All roads lead to Doug. I think the, y'all have done an amazing job showing both examples on the ground. And I just want to kind of restate what you all did very quickly for the audience, is thinking about, you know, well, what we need to change here. You said it really well, Beth, about, you know, innovation means not just doing things the same way. And, you know, what did we talk about? You've got to get the lawyers and the rest of the staff need to be on the same page. It'd be very helpful to have political leadership help provide guidance, air cover, really important. What keeps coming up, and it's not a cop-out, I think it's really important for folks who are listening today to hear from executive staff who worked on the Hill too, who are saying, look, we need Hill buy-in, right? And I think, Doug, you said it really well, that kind of continued support, right? When that wavers, that creates problems. But again, we also heard this kind of great silver lining that it really benefits people. And Maria started off so great talking about how well this built relationships, right? And as challenging as it was one of the most rewarding jobs too. So I think there's a lot of upside here. We've gotten more questions from the audience than we could possibly handle, including ones in advance. I want to actually pull one out, and then we'll end with a last question on, like, kind of the, you know, like almost like saving it for them. Like, would you relaunch this thing? So flagging it, you know, more for the audience. They know it's coming. But we actually had this question I think can apply to all three of you, from Zelda Yanovich, if I'm saying that right, who's a senior initiatives manager at the Lego Foundation, which I also just love with my little kids. I'm going to reframe her question a little bit to make sure it applies to everyone, but it's this concept of a 10 or 15 minute city, which I think everyone who's probably logging in today, certainly all three of you know about, right? But what she's bringing up here is, how can we think about building more sustainable places and connecting different dispersed centers to one another in the neighborhoods around them? Do you see that as something where a future kind of set of, whether formally or informally coordinated, grants from the federal kind of apparatus can help? What would you respond to Zelda to, if she was here to ask her question directly?
I said I'm not going first, so somebody has to go first. Beth,
I'm making Doug here.
Valley. Go for it, Beth. You all right? Well, I think the response is I assume that Maria or Beth would go first, actually. So I was thinking about something else.
I'll jump in. I will say that we need to do a lot to get out of the way of that. I think we're under the impression that there's a lot of things when it comes to the built environment that we believe wrongly. We believe it's permanent. It is not. Believing that buildings and the built environment is permanent is something we say in our brains to comfort ourselves, because it's not comforting to think about the fact that it's making itself over nonstop, but it is. And the only question we have as a society is whether or not we are going to participate in that change to get better outcomes. We have played bystanders, and rather sloppy bystanders at that, and acted like it was happening to us like a weather event, and it is not. And so I think as our cities, remake themselves on a very regular and actually quite speedy basis, we need to think about steering that in a direction that matches our actual goals. Right now, they're undercutting almost every single last one of them in terms of cost to people, in terms of cost to government, in terms of climate, in terms of equity, in terms of economic strength. And we need to undo that. And a lot of it is coming from the feds. We actually prevent the good things we claim we want. Now, we're not the only ones. The states do plenty of it themselves, and the locals do plenty of it. I've got a coalition of developers we work with who often participate in a process where we'll go into a community and show a project they worked on. And all the things like there's a project to build affordable housing for homeless vets on top of a transit system or a transit stop that would also redo a brownfield. And in order to do this development, they needed 16 exemptions from local law. We are in our way. And I think the feds need to really do an accounting of how many ways they make it illegal to do the things we're telling people to do, and update a lot of our guidances and help the locals. So, I just kind of ticking through a handful of them. 100 years ago this year, Herbert Hoover and the Department of Commerce pulled a bunch of experts together to set land use policy, not knowing that we wouldn't be smart enough to update it after 100 years. He was responding to the problems of the early 20th century, overcrowded cities, lack of sewage and water treatment, and highly polluting industry right next to where people lived. We're still responding to that crisis. That crisis has been long gone, but we still have rules in place. They've created new crises, and the feds have acted like they had no role in creating this. And the feds won't even provide tools and guidance to help people update it. The attitude from the feds is 84,000 local governments should independently figure this out one by one, no matter their capacity. I'd say time to pull a group of experts together and talk about some recommended updates to at least give locals some basic guidance and some tools they can use to do updates. I would say we can really start teaching people to deploy new technology as well, to like GIS, to get a better sense of how the system is operating. Mm-hmm. Those are just two ideas.
No, that's great.
I would agree with
one minute for someone else to respond, kind of dissolves.
Okay, I'll keep it real quick. I agree with that. The one thing I would mention is, building off of that, we do a very bad job in this country of actually saying what the goals and the outcomes are that we want. Instead, we micromanage like the inertia. And I think, one thing we have seen with COVID is more flexibility from the federal government to say, deal with this crisis. There are many different ways that depend on your local context and ingenuity and creativity. That's what I think we were trying to do with the partnership. And we kept running into, that's not how Congress or federal agencies have envisioned the federal government.
We didn't, so, there wasn't enough of a crisis. There wasn't a crisis mentality, and that's what it takes.
Right. Well, and it's still reactionary and not like, what are we aspiring to? So let's aspire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really well said. And I think all three of you, certainly Maria and Beth especially, know we are all equally obsessed at the Brookings Metro Program on trying to use an outcomes-driven framework. And it is too easy in the built environment, kind of super space, if you will, to assume that the outcomes are predetermined and we're all rowing in the same direction, which I think is a great way to kind of set up a closing question here, which is, not just a simple yes or no, I wouldn't or wouldn't relaunch this thing. But let me frame it like this. Do we gain, as a kind of nationally speaking, but also in communities, do we gain as a society if we have this program? Is this a like cost benefit style? Is this something with net benefits? If we can relaunch a version of this program, taking in a lot of the advice that you all had today, let's maybe go in the same, because feeling Maria here, the reverse alphabetical order, we always get crushed with these late lettered last names. So starting with you, Maria, Do you think this is kind of a net benefit, and would you push folks to relaunch this?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the fact that there were almost $40 billion requested for the roughly $4 billion that was allocated is just a pure fact that there is a huge demand, a huge unmet demand to do things differently and do it in an integrated way. I don't think it needs to be, as Ron said, just like take it, dust it off, bring it back. Like, we're smarter, we're better, we've learned things, we have different crises. So yes, some type of cross-agency partnership with a set of shared principles across the government and ways to actualize that in a clear pathway forward. Amen. Sign me up.
Really well said. Beth, same to you.
Yeah, I'd say if it's just a series of meetings or requires its own pot of funding to last forever in order for this to be useful, then no, it's not worthwhile. But if we have a specific to-do list, preferably on an annual basis, where we're going to start to identify those real substantive changes that need to occur at the administrative level, then it would be invaluable.
Really well said.
And I'll just say, I'll name three things. The need to address resiliency in the face of climate change, the focus on racial equity and inequality, and actually a third one is the changing nature of work, of where people spend their, you know, that one third of all their time is a lot different. The only way that the federal government is going to really make an impact in these three areas is if agencies work together. And the resources, I mean, we had ARRA, but it's a whole different thing now, you know? So I think the question is, it's absolutely, you know, does it have to look exactly like we did it 12 years ago? Absolutely not, to Beth's point. It needs to be better.
That's such a nice way to end. You know, a mini two cents here is, I think one theme I didn't pick up on earlier that, I mean, was there and I didn't elucidate it, but I want to kind of close with it on this, is that the communities know what they need. They know how to help. I think Beth, you just said, well, in the prior comment on, let's not block them, let's help support them. There's ways to make these funding streams connect at the local level, whether if that's too hard federally, but having what I heard today, having the agencies just talk to each other more and connecting to that bigger sense of purpose can really help the country. So I hope folks walk away thinking that there's a lot of fertile ground here that we can grow something out of. And I hope you also learn some lessons in the candidness. I cannot thank Maria, Beth, and Doug enough for the candidness of your comments. We don't always get this at programs. And Ron, for motivating all of us right at the beginning. And certainly it's just a nice way to start your day to hear that kind of commentary. So I agree. I'm now jealous, Maria, what you got for all those years when he was over there too. So again, I want to thank everyone for tuning in. This will be recorded for posterity and available on a URL on the Brookings website. Please make sure you check out and connect with Maria, Beth, and Doug's respective work at each of their agencies and private firms too. And we look forward to seeing you again at the next event that we host at Brookings. Thanks, and enjoy the rest of your day.